Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Charlie Mitchell, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why a coalition of civil liberties advocates from across the political spectrum oppose President Bush's call to renew key provisions of the USA Patriot Act. Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who discusses the campaign he says is being waged by anti-immigrant groups to take over the Sierra Club. And William Fisher, who reports on the fourth annual World Social Forum in Bombay, India, where more than 100,000 progressive activists from around the globe met to envision a more just world. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Global activists united behind the New Delhi, India-based People's World Water Forum have launched a far-reaching campaign against Coca-Cola and Suez Degremont for pushing privatization of drinking water supplies. In rolling out the new anti-corporate campaign, Vandana Shiva of the nonprofit group Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology charged, "These two companies are the prime exploiters of global water sources. Suez leads in privatization of water in most countries, and Coke leads in having conflicts with local people over groundwater mining." The Water Campaign has activists from over 60 countries. Its first major effort was to educate the citizens of India about the perils of privatization during a 1,500-kilometer train ride from New Delhi to Mumbai, the site of the World Social Forum. According to the website oneworld.net, the citizens' movement also promises to lobby the United Nations to make sure the international body declares water a fundamental right during the upcoming summit on ecological, social, and cultural rights. Tony Clark of the Canadian-based Polaris Institute added that the World Bank and International Monetary Fund will become the targets of water activists for promoting privatization of water systems. Clark explained, "We want to pressure the World Bank into supporting public water utilities and respecting the human right to water." The so-called Mexico City policy, which eliminated U.S. funding for international agencies that address abortion issues, was first instituted by the Reagan administration at a 1984 United Nations Population Conference in Mexico City. It denied U.S. AID funds to any non-governmental agencies discussing abortion, either through counseling, referral, or by lobbying to make it legal. In effect, the Mexico City policy made it impossible for family planning centers and health clinics in the developing world to even talk about abortion as an option. The anti-choice policy was quickly reversed by Bill Clinton in 1993, but President George W. Bush reinstituted the restrictive policy right after he was sworn in. The American Prospect magazine reports that in recent months, family planning groups such as Population International and Planned Parenthood have released new research showing the dire impact of the Mexico City policy on poor women. In a report titled Access Denied, reproductive rights advocates found that five family planning clinics in Kenya, hard hit by the AIDS epidemic, were forced to close since the 2001 Bush order. A single clinic in the slums of Nairobi had served 300,000 people. Supplies of U.S.-donated contraceptives, including condoms, were denied or severely limited to 29 nations because of the gag rule. Despite strong right-wing support for the gag rule, polls show that 70% of the American people support government funding for international family planning programs. The Economist magazine reports there is another voter recount fiasco emerging in Florida. On January 6th, Florida voters in Broward and Palm Beach counties cast over 10,000 ballots for a state House of Representatives seat, which Republican candidate Ellen Bogdanoff won by 12 votes. But there were 137 so-called undervotes, ballots where the voter's choice failed to register in the new digital voting machines. State law requires a recount, but a complete recount is impossible since new touchscreen voting machines were used and there is no paper trail for each individual vote cast. Congressman Robert Wexler, a Democrat, filed a lawsuit saying that the new digital voting machines violated state law. He also sought a court order to equip new touchscreen machines with printers that would allow each voter to create a paper record of their vote. In recent months, makers of digital voting machines like Diebold have come under fire for their political ties to the Republican Party and for various software flaws that make the new voting machines susceptible to hackers. Voting experts say there is a simple solution: require a paper copy for each ballot cast for the individual voter to inspect. Already, California has mandated a paper ballot trail for all elections after 2006. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.
In his State of the Union address delivered to the nation on January 20th, President Bush called on Congress to renew key provisions of the USA Patriot Act set to expire next year. Mr. Bush stated that the Patriot Act provided the tools needed by law enforcement to protect Americans from future terrorist attacks. But more than 2 years after September 11th and quick congressional passage of the Patriot Act, a grassroots coalition of civil liberties advocates from across the political spectrum have been increasingly critical of the legislation that they assert weakens protections embodied in the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. Among the provisions of the act that most concern activists are Section 215, which allows the FBI to collect evidence and private records without judicial review. Around the country, more than 230 local governments and three state legislatures have passed resolutions condemning the Patriot Act. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Charlie Mitchell, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, who explains why the ACLU and other groups oppose the president's call to make the USA Patriot Act a permanent part of American law.
Out of many dozens of sections that make up the Patriot Act, there are only about 12 that are subject to the sunset, which would be December 31st of 2005. And the sunset doesn't mean they'd go away. It just means that Congress has to review them and see if they've been used appropriately and if they're effective. Our position is, of course, that's the wrong way to go. We've actually argued for the amendment of some of these measures and the outright repeal of some of them. And, in fact, we want more of the Patriot Act subject to sunset so it gets a full, thorough congressional review. Frankly, at the ACLU, we were a little bit shocked that they would make this call in his State of the Union, because it just sort of runs contrary to what we've seen as the sentiment both in public, where we've had over 240 communities pass resolutions expressing their being opposed to the Patriot Act, and also the atmosphere we've seen on the Hill, where many, many Republicans are even starting to sign up on bills such as the SAFE Act that address these provisions.
Maybe you could summarize some of the provisions that you find the most objectionable and that you would like to see expire.
Sure. One of the provisions that has got a lot of attention around the country is the Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which has gotten its most attention in the way it's been applied or could be applied to libraries. And what that is it's taking a tool that was available in terrorism investigations and was available in intelligence investigations and really allowing the government to use that tool, which doesn't have the normal safeguards that would apply to criminal procedures, and use it on ordinary Americans and in all types of situations, on all businesses and all libraries, any sort of establishment to get their records under a very low standard. That's one we'd like to see addressed. We've actually not proposed repealing it. We've proposed limiting it to its application the way it was designed, to be used on agents of foreign powers and terrorists. Another provision that is not subject to sunset, and we would like to see, again, revised, not repealed, is the sneak and peek searches. That's Section 213 of the Patriot Act. It allows the government to come into your home, search your home, even take things from your home and not tell you until they decide the time is right. We've just wanted to amend that to make sure that there are judges involved in the process and eventually the government has to tell you they were there.
Congress, I believe, has taken action already on the sneak and peek provisions. You want to fill us in a little bit about what Congress's role here could be in changing this thing?
There's, in fact, a bill in the Senate and in the House, both named the SAFE Act. And this bill in the Senate side is sponsored by Senator Larry Craig, a Republican from Idaho, with four Republican Senate co-sponsors and hopefully more soon. And on the House side as well, there are over seven Republican co-sponsors, I believe, on the House version of SAFE. And the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, a Republican from Wisconsin, Representative Sensenbrenner, when asked about repealing the sunsets without having the time to review them and following the original schedule, set over his dead body. So we do have some hope that on the Hill that the Congress will take its oversight responsibility very seriously.
One of the responses from Attorney General John Ashcroft and others in the Bush administration in response to criticism about some of these provisions in the Patriot Act is that he say critics really can't point to any place, any specific time or case in which the Patriot Act has been abusive of people's rights. Is that an accurate statement in your view?
Well, that is not an accurate statement from the position of the ACLU. There are specific abuses, and the ACLU is preparing to release a report on that. Sometimes it's over-aggressive prosecution. For example, there was a lovesick 20-year-old girl on a cruise ship off of California who put a threatening note on the boat because she wanted to go home and see her boyfriend. Now, obviously, that is wrong, and obviously she should be punished, but the government went ahead and charged her with federal crime of terrorism, and she's serving 2 years in federal prison. Another thing that concerns us is that when this law was passed, many members of Congress accepted some of the lessening in civil liberty protections because they thought it would only be used on terrorists. And in fact, the Department of Justice billed this as being a bill that would only address terrorism and would never be applied on ordinary Americans. Well, the Department of Justice is now bragging about their successes in normal criminal investigations. They've used the Patriot Act to investigate a political corruption case in Las Vegas. So that's a concern, that this law is now being used on ordinary Americans in cases that have absolutely nothing to do with terrorism.
What do you suggest concerned citizens do at this moment that could be effective in preserving our Bill of Rights, our civil liberties, in the face of the continuing threats of terrorism and the Bush administration's reaction to those threats embodied in particular provisions of the Patriot Act that you see as detrimental to those rights?
Well, the first thing I would recommend is these kids continue to organize at a community level and pass these community resolutions. It's having an amazing effect on the dialogue on the Hill. And it's also really amazing to see communities get together and discuss civil liberties, which is a very important feature in our democracy. I think a second thing is this is an election year. You know, talk to the members. Ask the candidates how they stand on protecting your civil liberties. And in terms of with your current representatives, contact them and tell them to co-sponsor the SAFE Act. On the House side, it's H.R. 3352 by Representative Otter from Idaho. And on the Senate side, it is S-1709 by Senator Craig from Idaho.
That was Charlie Mitchell, legislative counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. Contact the ACLU by calling area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at www.aclu.org. The Sierra Club, the nation's oldest and largest environmental organization, is facing what many activists inside and outside the group say is the gravest threat to its survival in its 112-year history. Founded in 1892 by Scottish immigrant John Muir, some members of the board of directors are seeking to have the club adopt an anti-immigration platform. Three more board candidates with similar views have petitioned their way onto the ballot for the March election. They argue that greater numbers of people coming to the U.S. will deplete the nation's resources and strain ecosystems. Their solution is to severely restrict immigration. For 20 years, Mark Potok, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Report, has been researching the radical right, which includes many anti-immigrant organizations that he classifies as hate groups. Potok says he has uncovered both public and private documents that reveal a focused campaign by these groups to take over the Sierra Club. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Potok, who examines the objectives of these anti-immigrant groups, what chance they have of success, and what Sierra Club members who oppose anti-immigration policies are doing to protect what they consider the integrity of one of the nation's most important environmental organizations.
The basic idea is that the club is seen as a liberal organization, a very respectable organization, an organization which could never be accused of racism, certainly. And therefore, from the point of view of many anti-immigration activists, a kind of perfect vehicle to make the argument in favor of essentially shutting down the nation's borders. You know, basically what we are saying is that some individuals, led by a couple of board members, current Sierra Club board members, allied with a number of people outside the club, are engaged in this kind of takeover attempt. You know, we're not saying that every person involved in this is some kind of, you know, wicked white supremacist or Klansman, but certainly there are those ties.
Talk a little bit more about those ties.
As long ago as 1986, a man named John Tanton, who was really kind of the impresario of the anti-immigration movement, talked about, in a secret memo, trying to target the Sierra Club. He said something like, you know, the Sierra Club may not be ready for us, but we're ready for the Sierra Club. And he talked specifically about the idea of needing a kind of liberal organization to make this anti-immigration argument. That was talked about internally for many years, and Tanton, in fact, in the current attempt, at least has some role. We know that last fall, John Tanton, who runs a hate group, something called the Social Contract Press, was advertising in his journal, The Social Contracting, asking people to join the club in order to influence the vote. Tanton is certainly no Klansman, but there are Klan-like groups, much harder-line groups than his out there, encouraging their members, this even includes some neo-Nazi groups, to join the Sierra Club in order to influence this vote. We have three people running for the board on a immigration restriction ticket, in effect. You know, these people are presenting themselves as some kind of environmentalists when, in fact, they really have no background in the Sierra Club or environmentalism at all. And, in fact, all three sit on the boards of anti-immigration groups which have received over $2 million in funding from the SCAFE Foundation. These, of course, are the hard-right foundations started by Richard Mellon Scaife and his family, which funded the Arkansas Project and the whole series of attacks on the Clintons. So it's, you know, rather ironic, I think, that extremely few Sierra Club members would find themselves in sympathy with the Scaife Foundation or their aims. So that is really what's going on. You know, there's a real effort to close down the borders, to impose, you know, extremely stringent immigration legislation, and we think that it is essentially driven by bigoted ideas. Essentially, what we are saying is that this kind of turning of the Sierra Club, or this attempt to turn the Sierra Club to an entirely different mission than the work it has done in the past, has the very serious potential to wreck the club, or at least to gravely weaken it. I don't think there's any question, for instance, that the majority of the staff will quit if, in fact, the anti-immigration group takes over. And just to kind of emphasize, you know, how seriously this is seen, not only by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but by key people in the Sierra Club, just a few days ago, 13 former presidents of the club sent a letter to the current board saying, you know, this is the gravest crisis threatening the Sierra Club in its entire 112-year history.
Well, one can make an environmental argument for reducing immigration to the U.S. that is perhaps not racist, because it simply says that people who live in highly developed nations, whether native-born or immigrant, tend to consume more resources than people living in the less developed countries that most immigrants come from.
Certainly true. Let me tell you that. You know, the Sierra Club up until now has had a policy in favor of stabilizing and even reducing global population. And there is certainly nothing untoward about that as a goal. I think most environmentalists would agree with that. Where the dispute really comes in is the answer to environmental global problems to kind of seal up the United States and try and create a little, you know, island of environmental, you know, nirvana all by itself. The club's attitude and, in fact, program has been to work to empower women in other countries, to defend women's reproductive rights, and in numbers of ways like that, to encourage family planning around the planet, and also to help toward economic development that will help people reduce the size of their families. That, I think, is the only ultimate answer. You know, let me say, too, that the Southern Poverty Law Center really has no position on immigration. We are not immigration experts and don't pretend to be. However, you know, we do study the radical right quite closely and have for many years, and it's through that lens that we're approaching this issue. You know, we are simply saying that this is a debate that ought not to be colored by bigotry.
That was Mark Potok, editor of the Southern Poverty Law Center's intelligence report. Contact the Law Center at area code 334-956-8303 or visit their website at www.splcenter.org. For more information on Sierra Club members' efforts to resist the anti-immigration platform, visit www.groundswellsierra.org. The World Social Forum, one of the largest international gatherings of progressive activists, drew more than 100,000 delegates to this year's event, held January 16th through the 21st in Bombay, India.
The forum, often described as part political summit meeting, part carnival, and part protest, had held its first three annual meetings in Porto Alegre, Brazil, but chose this year to move the gathering to Asia. Originally conceived as a venue to counter the World Economic Forum held annually in Davos, Switzerland, where elite business and political leaders gather to network and formulate policies, the World Social Forum has in many ways overshadowed its rival. Activists, academics, workers, and students, representing diverse social justice movements, come to the World Social Forum to participate in workshops, seminars, and strategy sessions, exploring alternative models for equitable economic and environmentally sustainable development. Last year's forum gave birth to coordinated international protests opposing the Bush administration's planned invasion of Iraq. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with William Fisher, co-editor of the book Another World is Possible, Popular Alternatives to Globalization at the World Social Forum. Fisher, who just returned from the Bombay gathering, discusses some of the issues considered at this year's forum and the internal debate about the future of the Progressive Summit meeting.
Imagine 100,000 leftist activists coming together from different parts of the world with different kinds of agendas, with different kinds of causes that they're promoting, and all, you know, very visible talking to each other. But at the same time, it is a big brainstorming session. It's like a professional conference. So it operates at different kinds of levels. There is the sort of street life of it, which was particularly active in Bombay this year, very colorful visual parades and marches all over the place. And then there are the series of several thousand workshops that go on in which people go over some very, very serious issues and brainstorm about the best way to think about how another world could be possible. Another way to think about the World Social Forum is to think about the many different protests there have been, certainly in the United States, we're aware of it since Seattle in 99, but the different protests there have been against globalization around the world. Those get a lot of press and people know about them, and it's often been branded by the press as the anti-globalization movement. But what happens at Porto Alegre or at the World Social Forum for the first 3 years and again this year in Mumbai is people thinking not negatively about globalization, but in some positive way. How could it be different? How could you think of another world or another form of globalization that would be more just and more sustainable? And that's really the major work, I think, that goes on at the World Social Forum is people thinking about these ideas.
Describe for our listeners what the focus of the discussion, some of the important discussion that took place in Bombay at the World Social Forum.
Well, they were not unlike the focus of the discussions in the last couple of years. You find the same sort of major themes coming up time and time again. People are talking about the production of wealth and access to wealth and sustainability. They talk about how you could strengthen civil society and public spaces. They talk a lot about political power. There's a lot of talk now about the World Social Forum itself. That is, should the World Social Forum continue to be what it's been for its first 4 years of existence? And that is an open forum where there's a great deal of discussion. But there's no proclamation, there's no conclusions. Or should the World Social Forum turn into more of an instrument for political action? A lot of debate back and forth about which of those it really ought to be. There's a slight change when we went to Mumbai from Porto Alegre in the sense that by moving from one part of the world to another part of the world, the 100,000 people who attend really come from a slightly different cross-section of civil society groups or of national groups. And so the kinds of regional issues they bring to the table and they bring up for discussion vary a bit. In particular, I guess what seemed very obvious in Mumbai is that there was a lot more discussion about caste or ethnicity, about identity, and how that's affected by processes of globalization. Something that you saw less, I think, in the first three meetings in Porto Alegre. And if there's a big theme that really comes about out of all four of these social forums, it's really about democracy.
Where do you come down on the question of concrete action and the World Social Forum as a entity adopting some kind of program or strategy? Do you think that would destroy the spirit of open-ended dialogue, which contributes to that kind of informal networking, and would bog down various movements pitted against each other to battle it out over this or that issue? Or do you think that in order to tap the potential energy of this international movement, this diverse and kind of amorphous grouping, that you need to have a little bit of hierarchy and direction and need to make some decisions?
That's a great question. And the answer would be yes. I think that I come down very strongly on the side that sees the World Social Forum as an open space for discussion and for dialogue. And I think that's critical. It needs to remain that way, and it needs to remain this kind of forum where all ideas can be exchanged, where people feel that they can actually participate. But there also needs to be some sort of recognized way in which there's hierarchy, where there's movement towards clear political action. But I don't think that that has to happen within the World Social Forum itself. And I think that we'll begin to see some spin-offs and some networks around the World Social Forum that will recognize increasingly the need for some clearly directed political action, and that will work, I think, largely as if the World Social Forum is a kind of incubator, a kind of space where the ideas can be generated, and that they'll be from that loosely connected or spun off from the World Social Forum, but they won't act in the name of the World Social Forum. They'll act in the name of networks that frequently attend the World Social Forum. But I think you do need both. You need that open space, and we still need to come up with some way to make sure there's clearly directed political action.
That was William Fisher, co-editor, along with Thomas Panaya, of the book Another World is Possible, Popular Alternatives to Globalization at the World Social Forum. Visit the World Social Forum's website at www.wsfindia.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.